Hello, everybody. Dave Wallen and I welcome our friends who have joined us this evening for the first episode of Race Talk with Trish. Tonight, we want to introduce you to a racer unknown to a few but respected by many. Charles Downs is exemplary on many levels. Born in South America, his family moved to Brooklyn, New York when he was 17. After returning home from the tour of Vietnam and feeding his addiction to racing by autocrossing on various tracks on Sundays, he met Walt Boren and joined him on his RX2 team at Road Atlanta in 1975. His time with Walt taught him about the workings of the team and the mindset of a racer. His first race was in an RX7 and SECA showroom stock in 1981. He went on to contest IMSA's Renault Cup in 82 for several seasons, going to France with Parker Johnstone and Mitch Wright, and winning the championship in 84. From there, he raced Mazdas and BMWs, enjoying full-time rides for Honda, Eagle, and BMW in IMSA's Escort and Firehawk series. As his competitive career wound down, he conducted ride and drives at the Porsche Experience Center in Los Angeles and did testing for teams such as TRG up in Wine Country. Charles comes to us with an encyclopedic grasp of teams, drivers, cars, tracks, and events during IMSA's formative and most interesting years. He's forgotten nothing. So this is a guy whose words you'll want to hear and absorb. Ask questions and enjoy his experience. Thank you again.
Hello, everyone. It's Charlie Downs. Trish, thanks for the kind words, but I think you went a little overboard. I only remember what I can remember. But, yes, you covered everything succinctly. For those who don't know, I originally came into IMSA with Walt Boren, and that in itself was a story. Had been, as Trish said, had been terrorizing everybody in Brooklyn at autocrosses. In those days, they were called Gymkhanas, and we had an old Air Force base, Floyd Bennett Field in Brooklyn, that hosted Gymkhanas every Sunday. And most of the guys who came there got tired of me beating up on that. One guy in particular convinced me that we should go racing. He had the money, and I thought I had the brains. So having the brains, I decided we should learn from somebody who was already running a team. I was a rotary buff, had just bought the first RX-4 that came into Long Island, and was following Walt Boren, who lived in New Jersey. I lived in Long Island. So I called his father. We had a conversation. He invited me over to their house in Flemington. I got over there, and we had a long conversation with him and his wife. Eventually, they called Walt, who was at his race shop. And Walt and Charlie Hurst came over to the house and met me, and we sat down and had a long conversation. And when I was leaving, they said, well, you know, we're racing next weekend in Road Atlanta. If you're that interested, you're welcome to come along. So I did. The first person I saw at Road Atlanta, walked up to the line for registration, and Peg Bishop called me over. I didn't know who it was at the time, but she called me over, started to sign me in. And as she was finishing, she says, do you know where Walt Pitt is? And I said, no. And just so happens, serendipitously, John Bishop is behind her, walks up behind her, puts his hands on her shoulder. He'd heard the last part of the conversation. So he said, hey, you know, I'm headed to the pits. I'll take you and show you where it is. I didn't know who it was at the time, but he took me out in his golf cart, introduced himself, and then gave me a tour of the infield, then the paddock, and then took me to Walt's pit to drop me off. And that was my Great introduction call. To John IMSA. I have very fond memories of John Bishop himself. Initially, being with Walt and the rest of the Mazda teams, it was literally one big family, even with the GT crews. We'd often go to a track, and at the end of a day, you'd hear someone come by and say, "Hey, we're all gathering at X, Y, and Z restaurant," and everybody seemed to know some of the best restaurants in the towns wherever we went. So that in itself was very enjoyable for me as a gourmand, someone who likes to eat but doesn't know how to cook. So that was my introduction to IMSA. Eventually, I started out again as a gopher for Walt. But Walt saw me at a gymkhana one time. We were at Pocono. And he said, "You know, you ought to get in a car. You'll do well." And I took his advice, bought an RX-7, and had two races in that to get my license. And it was the end of the season. At the end of that season is when the Renault Cup came into being, which again was another serendipitous event in my lifeline, because it literally afforded all the Walter Middies in the world who couldn't afford to go racing, especially pro racing, to do something that was really competitive. So I did that. The first year was a huge learning curve for me, especially having the ability to run up front but not the experience, and gaining that experience because we had people who raced that first year like Amos Johnson and Dennis Shaw and James Reeve, who came in and literally, if you hadn't learned anything, you had no choice but to learn, because those guys would whoop you up one side and down the other. So I learned lots of valuable lessons. And that year was a learning year. The next year was a better year. And the third year was even better because I won the championship. Ended up going to France with Parker Johnstone and Mitch Wright. And that is my first venture into pro driving, or driving at a pro level. Renault Cup was probably the best thing that happened to any number of us. I can probably name 120 guys who came through Renault Cup who were excellent drivers, and even if they were back markers, became better drivers at the end of their Renault Cup stints. So I always give it credit for the driver that I became after. Not everybody knows my CV, so to speak, but for having less than a total of 60 races in my whole career, because there were years when I couldn't get rides for one reason or another. There were some years that I didn't have a ride at all. Some years I had one race or two races. Other years I had several, which took me from Renault Cup to Dave Wolin. Now, it's interesting. Dave Wolin was the second multiracial team that I drove for, the only two, so to speak. The first was in Renault Cup. The owner of the team that I drove for was Italian, but he had a series of people who drove for him. I was from South America, Guyana. There was Lloyd Washington, who was from Jamaica. There was Tony. I'm having a senior block on Tony's name, but Tony was from Dominican Republic. And there was one more guy who was from Haiti. And again, that old age freeze got me. But so it was a multi-ethnic team. That was the first team. Dave Wolin was the second, myself and Ray Kong, and a number of other people on his team made it a multi-ethnic team. Dave, I drove for the first time. That was my second pro hire after Renault Cup. and he called and invited me to race with him at the Longest Day of Nelson, 1985. And that was an experience, but we did pretty good, had a good time with that. And because of Dave, I moved from New York to California in 86. In 86, we ran, well, both years we ran the Starion, and then Dave was one of the first people to put together the sport trucks. So I had the pleasure of helping him develop that, doing most of the testing there. And we had, or at least I had, some success, not a lot, because we got disqualified in the first race, but that's a story Dave can tell at another time. And from the Mitsubishi team, I moved to Honda, raced with Honda in Firehawk. Moved from Honda to Eagle in Firehawk, Paul Rossi's Eagles, and then World Challenge. World Challenge with several different BMW teams. Capacete Racing was its start in the BMW. I should also mention RX-7, the World Challenge, with Autocraft Racing from New York. So it's been an extensive career. There are things that don't come to mind right away, but there's a long history that's spread out over a long time, but not a lot of races. I've been lucky to have a lot of wins. But as I said, you know, I wish I could have had a career of 100, 200 races like most of the guys in the back in pro racing do. The guys up front like Petey or Lance Stewart or some of the other guys have probably got close to 1,000 races. But that's where it's at. I retired. My last pro race was World Challenge in 2000 at Charlotte. And started last and finished sixth. So that was my last hurrah. Trish, do you have anything you'd like me to add?
Well, let's see. We had said, I'd ask you the other day about your favorite tracks and why. And you said Lime Rock.
Well, Lime Rock is one because pretty much that's the first track I drove at and had a lot of success at. But I don't have a specific favorite track because I've enjoyed every track that I've been to, whether they were street courses or road courses. There are tracks that are challenges like No Sport in the Rain. There are street tracks that are...
Any place in the rain.
You know, there are some that are more difficult than others. But I don't have a real favorite track. Like I said, I have enjoyed every single one of them that I've been on. I've always looked forward to learning new tracks. I think it was one of my assets, getting to grips with something in a hurry. So that adds to the enjoyment. But rain races were my specialty. Lime Rock in the Rain in Renault Cup and lapping up to fifth place out of a 56 car field was fun. There are others that come to mind, like I said, Most Sport in the Rain. And I've done some Canadian Firehawk and Firestone Firehawk that were in the rain that were enjoyable. There was one particular race that I ran there in the Canadian Firehawk where it was just a monsoon. And even though the guys up there are real good in the rain, I enjoyed the challenge of that track in the rain. Road Atlanta, you know what that's like.
Yep.
That clay and rain just don't make for a great place, but it's a challenge, and I like it. The downside to Atlanta and the red clay is that You get home and you find that it's in your clothes. It's in the car that you washed. It's in just about everything for weeks after. But then if you've raced at Roland Lab in the rain, you've had that experience. Out at racetracks, street courses were a lot of fun. Street courses, the possibility of getting bitten by walls or somebody stopping unexpectedly in front of you with no place to go is a challenge, but most of them were fun. I look forward to them. Had good success with them. We've had, whether it's Columbus or places like Miami or the Tampa Fairgrounds or just several of them, Palm Beach. They all had different aspects that made them enjoyable. It includes running with good teams and teams that were competitive too.
Did you ever have a crash, a good one? There is no good one.
Oh, there are no good ones. The only one, well, there are a couple. In the Mitsubishi at Mosport, I had a rear end seize that turned to the downhill and ended up in the tire wall, which kind of vaulted the car. The corner workers were bug-eyed when they finally got to me, but apparently it had been quite a ways up in the air before it came back down on the side. Problem was that I'd slipped out of the harness, the seat belts, and my nose is over where the glove compartment would be, and the stick shift stuck a hole in my rib. So I had a broken rib.
Ouch.
And that's the only real, that's the only injury I've ever had. I've had my bell rung from glancing off the guardrail at Watkins Glen, and it was such a violent sideways that my head hit the roll bar in that car. The roll bar didn't have any padding, and I've never had my bell rung like that before or since. That's one you remember all the time, because I could hear the bees buzzing for hours after that. Other than that, in Renault Cup, a slow tip over on the side, and lucky that I didn't lose fingers, because I did a natural instinct for somebody who had never tipped over before and stuck my hand through the window. And luckily it was on grass and sand, so that when the side of the car came down on my hand, it didn't really do a lot other than make it swell. But I was lucky that it was not tarmac or something hard, because I would have been fingerless.
Ouch.
So I learned after that, ouch is right. I still have a bone spur as a reminder from that.
Ooh.
But it just, you know, today the window nets are better and you're in the car a lot better. So, and you don't have a big tippy car like the Renault Cups were. So nobody's really going over on the side. If they do, then that'll be a hell of a lot worse than what I experienced. So I don't wish that on anybody, but stuff does happen.
If you have the opportunity to back up and do it over again, what team and car could you visualize yourself in?
I am want to say any car, and professional teams, you'd be happy to race with any of them. So it's no specific team, just people with competent people aiming to win. One of the good things about the old days of when the factories were in endurance race and showroom stock is that they weren't interested in anything but a winning effort. So they look for people who could help them, which is good. And they try to provide you with the best thing that they could, which is also good. So those are the days that I miss. After the factory teams went away, it became independence. And that's a different philosophy, because the idea then is there's a business, and it's not necessarily to get a talented guy. It's more consequential to get a guy who can help you make your business successful. So things changed drastically once the factories had left showroom stock and endurance racing. They're still kind of in it, but it's more the majority of fields today are independent teams. So that's one big change in the 70s, 80s, early 90s to what you have today, where I couldn't imagine getting into racing today. We raced in World Challenge on a budget of probably about $60,000 for a year. I can't even buy you a car now. A Miata. Spec Miata right now is more than that, just for the car. And, you know, $60,000 at that time was a car, keeping it running and getting to the races and paying your bills. So it's a quantum leap. And like I said, unless you've been lucky in the last 15, 20 years to accumulate wealth, there's not much chance that you're doing anything. Even karting, from what I understand, has gotten exponentially more expensive. So it's really difficult. I feel for kids who are interested in it these days, which I could help, but nobody wants your help unless you can monetize your experience or your presence.
That's unfortunate. Dave, you want to open it up to questions? Come in, Dave.
If there's anyone out there who would like to ask a question, I am open to it.
Hey, Charlie, Ed Magner here. Tell us about some of your favorite photographs.
Say that again, Ed. I've been meaning to get in touch with you, but say that again. I didn't hear you.
Tell us about your favorite co-drivers. Who are some of your more interesting co-drivers?
I've had lots of interesting co-drivers. One of the guys who really helped me a lot, Scott Gaillard, was influential in me going from Mitsubishi to Honda. I've had at start with teammates at Mitsubishi. There was Ray Kong. There was Sweet. I can't think of his first name right now. Mike Rutherford, John Norris. So we had a pretty good bunch of folks there that worked well together. I went to Honda and drove with Scott Gaillard, Petey Cunningham. I did a couple with Lance and I am trying to think. We had a teammate from Canada, and I cannot think of his name right now. But he was also good. I tell you what, make it easier on me. Who would you like to hear about? I know that's where you're headed.
But just some of the war stories, and really want to know. I want you to tell me something funny about Frank Delvecchio and the motorhome. I'm not sure what it's about, but
what I remember about Frank Delvecchio is he's one funny guy. He was the first guy that introduced Well, he's the only guy I'd ever seen with tongue puppets, but boy, that tickled the female audience in the pit and paddock seemed to appreciate those wiggly fingers coming out of his face. But that'll always be the way I remember Frank. But there are many motorhome stories, not just Frank. There's Al Salerno. There's all kinds of stories. Some can be told and some shouldn't be told. But Frank was just a really funny guy. He also introduced me to fishing at Lime Rock, where I caught a trout that he never knew in the back. He never knew about in the back because he fished the stream along the front straight. And I found that there was a hidden creek in the back behind Big Bend, where most of the big trout hid. So I managed to catch a pretty big one back there, which I was proud of. But those are the things that I remember about Frank. The motorhome? Not really. But those are the things I remember about Frank. You were one of the people that I always wished I'd driven with, but never got to because for whatever reason. But there are lots of people that I wish I could have driven with. Teammates.
Yeah, we were kind of on parallel paths there. We were always kind of around each other and running different things at different times. I remember being in that Charlotte race in 2000 as well. So our paths always cross. We're always on a racetrack together, but never together.
That's true. You had your corporate things to take care of, and I understood that, but always admired what you did. And I forgot to mention another one of my teammates who I should never forget, Roberto Lorenzuti. We drove together at Paul Rossi. Some of the other people at Paul Rossi, Garth Ellum, Terry Irwood, and a few other people that I raced with in that team. But Roberto, I've known from the time I started, because when I started, when I did my two SCCA races, at that time, Roberto was running at Datsun, I think it's called a 311. He ran the Nationals. And Lloyd Washington, who I ended up with eventually as a teammate in Renault Cup, he also ran at Datsun, but had gone to Road Atlanta to the runoffs with the two of them the year before I actually began with Renault Cup. So I knew Roberto from those days. And Roberto is still a friend. We still keep in touch, not as often as we should. But he's still in New York, and I'm out here in California. But one funny guy. Any other questions?
Hey, Charlie, Ray Kong.
Hello, Ray.
How you doing?
I'm glad you showed up.
You were thinking about Mitsubishi, and you couldn't remember Bob's name, Bob Sweet.
That's right, thanks.
Yeah, some of our more illustrious teammates, Charlie Hexum.
That's right. Charlie came in, I think, just as I was leaving. I left, I think it was just after Portland, and I think he came in just after that.
Yeah, and you forgot Scott's illustrious wife, Donna, who did quite well in the Hondas.
That's right. That is absolutely right. Donna, she's now Donna Gaylord, but she also ran with us in the Honda team. She was very good. But she gave up her life to become a mother of two guys who compete in the Colorado late model series, and they do very well. But Scott, I wish I could keep in touch with them more often, but they're always in my thoughts. Like I said, Scott is pretty much the person, I think, who convinced Dick Erickson to hire me at Honda. And that came about because of a race at Mid-Ohio where we ran. It was a 24-hour, and he was in the Honda, I was in the Starion, and we ran pretty close to each other for about an hour and a half. And at the end of that stint, he came over to find out who was driving the car, and that's when we first met.
Oh, so, okay. I did not know that.
Yeah. It was one of those funny things. You know, you run with somebody and you're back and forth and you really enjoy it in the middle of the night just racing somebody. So that's how that happened. And I think that experience is why he kind of recommended me to Dick. But I've always appreciated him putting that word out for me. Ray, for those who are listening, was a teammate of mine in Dave Wolin's Mitsubishi. We were the minorities in Dave Wolin's Mitsubishi team. Well, no, we weren't the only minorities. What was the name of the crew guy who was the native Indian? Ray?
Mark? Yeah, it was Mark, but I can't remember his last name.
Right, Mark. So it was a multi-ethnic team. So that again, like I said before, was the second multi-ethnic team that had been on. So it's pretty interesting. Why did you give up racing entirely after Trans Am?
There was nothing else really for me to do or to go to. You forget that we had a lot of diversity on that team. Charlie, in case people didn't know, Charlie Hexham drove with hand controls, and he had to be lifted out of a wheelchair in order to get into the car and out of the car for endurance racing for driver changes.
Mm-hmm. Right, that was one, I think, the first time we'd ever seen hand controls in a race car. I don't think anybody had done that before.
Right, yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you showed up, Ray.
Well, it was kind of last minute, and I just I sent it out to Scott and Donna, so I'm not sure if they made it on or not.
Well, is there anybody else who would like to ask a question? Apparently not. So, Ray, we can continue. Ed is somebody, you know, if Ed is still on, I have to call you because I've had a question for you that I have to ask off air that I've been mulling for quite a while.
Sure, Charlie. Give me a call anytime.
Will do. You got your license, right?
Say what?
Did you get your racing license again?
Yeah. Yep. I'm back and full medical and all the cardiac stuff's all working the way it should. So, we're ready to get back at it with some of the same old crap running it in vintage now. So.
Well, it's still running, still out there. You know, I'm 74 now, but I figure that Newman, he quit at what? 78, 79?
Yeah,
he was 80 when he did his last race.
Yeah, well, it looks like if I've still got the possibility somewhere down the line to come back a little bit, right? Even if it's vintage racing, but
it's really a lot of it's a lot of fun, especially dragging out the old Firehawk car to vintage stuff, and you run into a lot of people that used to watch them back in the day, and it's low key and people don't crash into each other on purpose like we used to.
I saw your post of your resurrected car, and apparently there are quite a number. I see a lot of interest in the old Gremlins from RS days and RX3. Yeah. So it looks like it'll be the way to come back for cheap racing.
Yep, for sure.
Cheap because it won't be cheap because you're going to spend a lot of money.
Well, yeah, the problem is there's still pieces in the barn from 30 years ago, so I still got a lot of old stock that I'm using up, so it's kind of a...
Well, that's good.
The good part of doing the same thing for so long, so...
Mm. Is Del Vecchio should have a couple of cars laying around, right? And
he's
a Formula car?
Yeah, he's got a Formula Ford that he runs up in the Northeast, and we keep talking about trying to get him back in the Olds occasionally here, and he's had his own cardiac issues a bit, nothing major like we've had, but enough to get his attention. So, and he's, I was trying to think how old he is. He's got to be 76, maybe. I think he's about your
age.
Somewhere
around there, yeah. Well, you know, somebody asked me about Parker Johnstone a few weeks ago, and Parker is still, he's back racing again, but just regional. It looks like regional and maybe some national stuff in the Northwest. And, you know, Mitch is still out there having fun. There's still quite a number of guys from back in those days who are still doing things. Still, some of the people, for example, from the old RS days are still active. I've spoken to Bobby Deal, Charlie Hurst, I tried to get in touch with, but found out it was too late that he'd passed on, and that's the problem when we don't keep in touch with people, you know.
Yep, for sure.
It's too many people that you eventually think, well, I should call. Then you call and find out, well, you miss them. They're gone. But, it's, you know, it's life, right? So we just have to make the best of it. But I think fondly of the old, before I started driving, the days of crewing with Walt, the Mazda family was really a family in those days, and I just had thoughts a while ago of things like not only the restaurant things, but leaving Road Atlanta and having Roger and Nancy Mandeville say, rather than driving all the way back to New Jersey, why don't you guys stop in for an overnight and staying with them overnight. Being out here on the West Coast and meeting some of the people from the Mazda West Coast, because Mazda at that time had one portion out here and the other, later on the headquarters was in Jacksonville, which this is an interesting story. Working with Walt gave me the opportunity to work with the Mazda team when they came to run the RX3s 78 at Daytona, and this is a Mazda Japanese factory team. I ran with them in 78 with the RX3s, and then 79 when they came back with the first RX7s. And what just popped into mind is a funny story from 78 when they first came over. The Japanese wives in Jacksonville came down to Daytona with this huge spread of all this wonderful Japanese food. I mean, I'd not seen sashimi and all the other stuff that they had. It was delicious. But all the Japanese mechanics, didn't touch any of that. They wanted McDonald's. They wanted Burger King. So they just, it was funny because we were eating all the Japanese food and they're cramming their faces with Burger King and Mickey D's. It was hilarious. And every time you look at them, they would just bob their heads and say, hi, it's good. But those are the fun things. But they were hard workers, the guys who raced, Urino and Tirada, and I could never think of the AC. He was like a samurai. Why can't I think of his name? But he was the number one guy, the number one Japanese guy. But he was awesome as a driver and just the leader of that team. And they came with two cars for each year. They had a Japanese car and an American car. And that's how I became involved as a crew person, because the crews from Roger, Jim, and Walt is who supported that team. Damon Barnett at that time was the head of Mazda Motorsports. And he looked after the American side, so to speak. And I've got Yoshino stuff. No, I can't think of his name right now. But they were regimented. They, just the way you see, you think of the older Japanese guys where there's one guy in charge and everybody knows that this is a guy, and every time he says something, you jump to it. That's what they were like. But they got things done. So that was pretty interesting from a team aspect and working with Mazda. The RX-3s are fun. I think Jim, if Trish can probably confirm it, Jim has one of the original RX-3s that came over that year.
The Gatorade car.
Right, and I'm not sure what...
And that gentleman you're trying to think of, his name is on the side of that car, and it's not coming to me either.
I've got too many Japanese names stuck in my mind, and it's not the
but
right one.
I see that car every single day that I'm in the office.
Right.
And
I always remember Terada, because Terada was cool. Terada was he was just this real bon vivant type of a guy, which you never expected from a Japanese guy. Plus,
he
in those
is.
Days, he, well, I'm glad to hear that. But in those days, there were two Japanese guys that had curls. It was him and Jim Meter, his partner, Oku. And I still, whenever I see Oku, I still tease him about his afro from that time. But Terada, I can't forget, and Urino, who was like the young up-and-coming guy. His name starts with a T, but it won't come to me. But it was an interesting time. No, it's Urino, who was a young guy, Terada, and I want to say Takahashi, but I don't think that's it. But it'll come to me when this is done.
That's how it works.
Anybody else? Yeah, especially at this age, it just seems it's just too. It's like a computer. It's just too much in there, and there's not enough gigs to handle it. Any other questions? And I know you've got interesting things arrayed that I should probably not divulge.
Matsushita. Was that it?
No, it wasn't Matsushita.
Okay.
Matsushita.
Okay, well, that's the best I can do with a southern accent.
Yeah, Matsushita is another guy. Like I said, it'll come to me when we're done. Which isn't any good, but I'll remember it then.
That's the only name I'm seeing, besides Terada.
Was somebody else saying something a moment ago?
We've got other people on here.
Who are some of the names on here? Maybe I can pry them, Trish.
You'd have to ask...
Dave.
Oh, Charlie, I was muted, so I couldn't say anything.
Oh, sorry.
Now you can hear
go
me,
ahead.
I think.
Yeah.
Oh,
we can.
You were talking about Parker Johnstone. Interesting story is he was my student at SECA Driving School in 1977. He drove a Ford Fiesta.
Oh,
really?
And maybe a lot of people don't know who Parker Johnstone is, but he went on to fame and fortune with Acura and Indy cars.
Yeah, Spice is a fabulous car.
Yeah, but for some reason, Parker doesn't quite remember that, which I think is funny.
Really?
I thought it was funny, but I always thought he was older than the age he always quoted.
Well, in 77, when he went through school, I was 21. So I'm not sure. How old does he say he is?
Well, he always looked 12.
Yeah, he did.
He always looked 12.
But even it back then, he was married to Sharon. Or no, he was his girlfriend. I'm sorry, she was his girlfriend. But they've been together that long.
That's right. I've got a picture of them when we were in France, so I can look at that every once in a while. But yeah, he's got the dealership. It's in Portland, I think.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he has a Acura Honda dealership, and I think it's Portland. It's right off the highway, right off 5.
Oh.
And I sometimes doubt myself as to whether it was Washington. Maybe it was near Seattle. It's either near Seattle or near Portland. Two different states.
Oh.
Somewhere up there.
Yeah, I think it's in Maine.
Again, Dave?
It's in Beaverton, south of Portland.
Okay, Beaverton. Okay. And I knew it was somewhere around there. I hadn't seen it for years, but recollect it was somewhere up there. But I've seen his name recently in some of the racing in Washington. They've got one or two tracks, the one in Kent, and another one someplace in addition to that. I've seen his name mentioned there. I think it's F Production or something like that. So he's back.
Yeah, there's a
having fun.
Yeah, there's a track in Kent, Washington, which I can barely recall. But I do recall they have two Red Lions very close to Portland.
Yeah, the one in the river is the one that I remember. Dave, you booked us into that Red Lion. Wasn't it the island between Oregon and Washington State?
Yeah, it's called Jansen Beach. Yeah. It was the closest hotel to the racetrack, as I recall.
Right. Right. Ray was reminding me about an episode we had there. But we crashed at it was a high school dance or something, right?
It was a high school reunion. And we were just trying to kind of fit in and mingled until some people figured out that nobody recognized us from the high school.
Nice.
Well, you had to have adventures on the road.
And is that Dave Wallen?
Yeah.
Hey, Dave, long time. Your voice sounds different.
That's because I'm old. Maybe
we're
it's a
all old. Day.
Yeah. You know, the Portland story, you guys might remember it. Our PR girl, I remember Debbie, our PR girl at the time, got to drive Paul Newman back to the hotel. And just a couple of years ago, I ran into her somewhere. She always relates that story. That was like the highlight of her life, of taking Paul Newman from Delta Park back to the Red Lion in Jansen Beach. As long as he didn't talk about movies, he was a cool guy. You know?
Where did we run into Paul Newman? When we all went to dinner, and I think it was with you, Dave, and Charlie, that we came into a restaurant, and Paul Newman was sitting there with a group of people. And we just, like, totally ignored him because we didn't want to bother him.
Well, wasn't that at Elmer's there in Portland, I think?
It might have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was another occasion there at Elmer's with Bob Hayes. Remember Bob Hayes from Airplane, who became a race car driver for a while? And he told stories of everybody cracking up for hours. They couldn't close the restaurant. They were too busy listening to him.
Oh, really?
All back in the day. That was in 1987, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, we have definitely had a lot of fun on the road, so And Dave, if you don't know it, I do live in Gardena, not far from where you have the shop here. And I'm right around the corner from where your favorite Carol's. So I'm still eating Japanese food here.
Yeah. You know, we used to pick the Mitsubishi executives up at the airport and take them to Gardena, to one of the Japanese restaurants, and they always wanted to go to McDonald's or go to Kuro's and have ribs, you know. And I entertained them, and in return, we'd get to do a lot of racing. Worked out well.
What about Fred? Is anybody hear from Fred?
I hear from him all the time.
Good.
Haven't seen him in a couple of years. He and Cindy were down here to Button Willow a couple of years ago.
So she still races?
Yeah, they're still running Vipers and whatever that Trans Am category is, TA3 or something, I think.
Now, didn't her family invite us out? They had a house on a lake off the river, up the east of Portland on the river, didn't they?
No, that was Monty Shelton's house.
Oh, okay. Well,
we went out there one time. We went out there one time when we were racing up there, if you remember. Yeah, that was Monty's house.
Okay. I remember that, but I thought it was the Lux's place.
Yeah.
And Monty's still around?
Monty's passed on. Charlie Hexham's passed on, and his wife remarried. We're still friends on Facebook. Not a lot of us left. Just young guys like Charlie and Ray.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I ran into Fred Lux in a park in Portland. I was up there not for a race, and just out of the blue, this is probably 20-something years ago, and I ran into him and Cindy up there just out of the blue. I mean, what kind of coincidence is that?
Well, that is a coincidence.
Yeah.
Oh. RSAs, Dave.
Hey, you know, we've got a million other things to talk about. We're running out of time here. But, part of the... That brief window in time from the early 80s until the early 90s, when every factory was involved in racing and every tire company was involved in racing. We had, with you and Ray, and you guys remember this, we're running a three-car team of Starions with three
right.
or four drivers each, and actually a huge budget, and pretty much dominated that class in racing for a couple of years. It was the good old days. And yet not many of us left who were there, so it's too bad. You know? I was actually at an event at the Peterson a while back with Roy Denklau, and hadn't seen him in a long time. Roy's in his middle 80s, living down in Julian or somewhere like that, down in San Diego. So we sat around.
You remember Roy
Denklau
from Toyo.
Right, Roy Denklau. I used to see him when I went to Mexico. He lived in a little town on the Sierra Cortez, but he moved back to the States. I haven't heard from him since. But he was doing
All the guys that are listening in here who weren't around back in the day, it was a pretty interesting time. I wrote that book, Sherman Stock, about those days because no one believed it happened. But beginning with Nelson Ledger's in 1984, and myself and a couple other people pretty much invented Sherman Stock endurance racing with Jim Truman putting on a 24-hour race at Mid-Ohio and Dick Gulstrand putting on a 12-hour at Willow. And the following year, by 1985, Bill King had convinced SCCA that there ought to be a series, and Gary Matheson got Playboy involved. And I convinced Mitsubishi they ought to pay me more money than they were paying me. And it kind of went on from there for about, 5 years. 1988, I think, was the last year of the Escort Series. And SCCA, of course, as they screwed up everything they ever did, couldn't find enough entrants because it cost so much money to run a 24-hour race. One year, I think we did three 24-hour races 1 year, and actually the cars are junk afterwards. I went through, when I moved out of my ranch and shop there in Riverside, I had 50 cars out in the field of old Starions and Eclipses that we had used and cut up, and sold them all to, I forget his name, a guy who's got a Mitsubishi Mazda shop in L.A., and he's probably still driving some of them, you know, Eclipses that won at Nelson Ledges and never turned a wheel again and that sort of thing. Anyway, these stories go on and on, have nothing to do with Charlie. You didn't tell us, by the way, speaking of Charlie, one story you can tell us about your crash at Mossport, because I think you hold a record there.
Yeah, the vaulting record. I did tell that story going off at turn two after the diff seized, hitting the wall, and the corner worker said it was probably about 10 feet up in the air sideways, came back down on the passenger side, and that's when I extended over to the glove compartment with my nose, and the gear shift stuck me in the ribs and broke it. Still got the hole in the rib. But that, yikes is right. But that's the only injury that I've ever had. Well, you know, the thing was, Mossport was one of those tracks you had to respect. But most of the guys who race know what turn two is like. For people who don't, it's a blind entry into a left downhill that drops off as it's turning, and you're going pretty much back the other way at the bottom of it. And the problem was, if you went off in the middle of it, you went down into literally a hole, a holler. Literally about probably 30 feet down from where you started. And if you went off a little further around the corner, they had an embankment that was fronted by tires. And those are the things that I hit broadside. And the tires is just like a giant spring, just vaulted the car up in the air.
Yep.
Further around that corner, if you lost it, there was a wall on the inside. So you had to really respect. I've seen people at Moss Corner lose it and end up right in the guardrail where the spectator sat. So it
yeah, Mossport is a great racetrack.
Yeah,
great racetrack. I think Dave had a pretty bad accident there as well in an F5000 car, if I recall.
Yes, I did. That was one of my few times I didn't blow the motor up. I crashed the car first. It's another topic. Red LeGrand saw me coming. I couldn't afford to buy an Eagle that I could fit in. And Red said, I'll build you one. He took a Formula B car and put a Chevy in it and said, here you go, kid. And every time I took it out, he ripped the half shafts out of it and ripped the rear radius rods out of it. And then at Moss's Corner, I came around there. Chassis flexed and jammed the tie rods against the chassis. I couldn't turn the wheel back and drove head on into the bank and broke my finger, the only injury ever in racing, but it turned me off on Formula 5000.
Oh.
I would hope so. Never did like open wheels. Did we have 1 year at Mossport when they had two of the Corvettes up on the guardrail, one on the inside at Moss Corner, and the other one straight up on the hill? People lost it in one of the races.
I can remember a lot of Corvettes laying on top of guardrails and off of the racetrack, but not specifically. But Mossport was always good for that, Charlie.
Yeah, you won that. I think it was the year you won. Who did you drive with in the vet? It was deeper.
I drove with Don Knowles. And it was with Kim Baker's team, but Don Knowles, a Canadian kid named Peter Hansen, and I don't remember if there we had two more drivers, but they didn't drive very much, if I recall.
So you had to do yeoman duty. I think it was that same race, because I'm thinking it was one of the Morrison Cook cars that ended up on the guardrail.
Oh, yeah. Well, Baker would only put myself or Don Knowles in the car whenever it was dark or damp. And that was like 18 hours of the race. So, we got a lot of seat time.
I can imagine. Anton Avoni, well, I kind of knew who he was because we run the Canadian Firehawk race. I ran with two kids, the Gwendolyn twins, that had a Corrado, and Hanson was one of the drivers of the team.
Oh, huh.
Same story, that he didn't do a lot of driving, but he was definitely a talker.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, no, it's good to hear from you, Dave. I hadn't heard from you for so long.
Well, you were in one of our showroom staff calls, I think, weren't you, Ray?
Yeah, very briefly. I got on very late, and so I missed like the first half of it.
Yeah. Well, that's what prompted doing these. That's going to be like a fun thing to do, and Trish is good at interviewing people. Speaking of that, by the way, we run out of recording time here in an hour, Trish, so you're back on.
Oh, boy. This has been more fun. I'm looking forward to doing this more. I'm hoping people will drop in and visit, ask questions, learn something new every time we do this.
And I understand you're going to do it bi-weekly, is that correct?
That's correct, but we're going to take a break for the holidays and come back after the first of the year. We'll have a wonderful lineup of people. But for this one, I want to say thank you to everyone. Charlie, you've been just wonderful.
I appreciate the invite and look forward to listening to more of your chats next year.
Oh, please do. Please do join us. And this has just been an experiment for all of us, and I think it's going to work out fine.
Excellent. Dave comes up with great ideas.
Yes, he does. He's a great partner. So in the meantime, everybody have a wonderful holiday season. Stay healthy. Take care of yourselves. And we will talk to you when we get back.
Thanks, Trish.